Good morning, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be able to introduce our first keynote speaker, Dr. Pat Levitt. Pat was born in a small town in New Jersey. By 1 year of age, his parents realized that they had a remarkable child on their hands. I'm going to skip over his formative years in the interest of time, but pause momentarily to mention his stellar basketball career, where he played for 1 year on the perennial powerhouse, University of Chicago, where he subsequently earned his BA or BS in, appropriately, in neuroscience, and then went on to a PhD in neuroscience at the University of California, San Diego. He completed his postdoctoral fellowship in neuroscience at Yale University. Pat, throughout his career, as many of you know, has held important leadership positions in neuroscience, neurobiology, and neurodevelopment at the University of Pittsburgh, at Vanderbilt, and most recently at the University of Southern California, where he's currently the Sims Mann Chair in Developmental Neurogenetics at Children's Hospital, Los Angeles, and the W.M. Keck Provost Professor of Neurogenetics at the Keck School of Medicine at USC. He has had a whole host of awards and important positions throughout his career. He was named a McKnight Foundation Scholar in 2002. He was a merit awardee from the NIMH, where he also served on NIMH Council. He's an elected fellow of the AAAS and an elected member of the esteemed National Academy of Medicine, formerly known as the Institute of Medicine of the National Academy of Sciences. He serves as the scientific director for the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child, which is a policy council that brings the best research from child development and neuroscience to assist policymakers and business leaders in making wise program investments and decisions. He served as senior editor for the Journal of Neuroscience and currently serves on the editorial boards of eLife, Neuron Cerebral Cortex Autism Research, Journal of Neurodevelopmental Disorders, etc. So if you have a rejection, Pat is the person to talk to. Dr. Levitt's research focuses on the development of brain architecture that controls learning, emotional behavior, and on the genetic and environmental factors that increase risk for autism spectrum disorders and other neurodevelopmental disorders, including schizophrenia. His clinical research addresses autism heterogeneity, and you'll hear more about that today, particularly looking at co-occurring medical conditions, including gastrointestinal disorders, with the goal of developing better diagnostics and personalized treatments. His CV is remarkable, over 250 papers. 55 of those have more than 100 sites. For those of you who like statistics, he has an H factor of 75, which is way up there. So it is a remarkable CV. In addition to everything else that I've described, his leadership at multiple universities and his contribution to overall science, he leads a highly productive laboratory. Am I making you leave? I'm going on for a while, Pat. He told me to keep it short. This is my version of keeping it short. He leads a highly productive laboratory that really studies everything from the developmental origins of the connectome of serotonin-containing RAFA neurons to the influence of social-emotional behavior, studying those at the biochemical, molecular systems, and behavioral levels. And I think truly remarkably for a laboratory with that kind of expertise also extends into clinical studies, where he currently has two large clinical trials underway, one called Tummy Troubles, which I think is the best name for a clinical trial ever, focusing on comorbid medical conditions, particularly gastrointestinal disorders, working with children with those conditions, studying social-emotional behavior, and then linking those to genetic models looking both at the GI and brain development. He has a second ongoing clinical trial looking at infant resilience and early adversity using EEG, studying oxidative stress biomarkers. So Pat, I think, has had a profound influence on how people think about neurodevelopmental disorders and studying them, in my view, by really constantly pushing us to recognize the intricacy, complexity, and centrality of understanding as deeply as we can brain development and of remembering that the brain is part of an entire organism. But I have to say, I wanted to make just one other comment, which was related to when I first met Pat. So when I think about the unprecedented size of this conference and look out really in this remarkable ballroom today and think about the scientific program that's going to unfold in the next couple of days. I do think back to my earliest experiences with Pat. I met him when he was the chair of the Scientific Advisory Board for Cure Autism Now. This is at the turn of the millennium when I think prior to the first MFAR meeting, when MFAR had several hundred as opposed to several thousand people. And so I served with him. He asked Dan Geschwin, and he asked me to sit on the Scientific Advisory Board and serve in grant review. And I have to say, you can learn a lot very quickly about someone by watching them not only review but also lead that kind of committee. And I knew immediately that Pat was a remarkable person. He always fought for the highest quality science. He always fought for science that was outside of the box. He always fought for young investigators. And he always fought for the highest risk, highest reward science through the lens of thinking about how ultimately that could impact individuals who are affected with autism as well as their families. So I think in often unappreciated ways, given where we were as a field, Pat, through that service really had a profound impact on how the science emerged. He played a crucial role at a crucial moment in the trajectory of autism science. And I think in one way or another, direct or indirect, he's had an enormous impact on what you're going to see over the next couple of days. So, Pat, thank you so much for accepting our invitation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is this on? Can you hear me? You're good. Okay. I'm not taking any phone calls. I just have a timer. Since, you know, there's no clock in here, Jerry. Okay. It's almost an out-of-body experience to hear somebody introduce you and you say, is that me? That's not me. I want to thank the NSAR meeting committee. How was that, Jerry? Was that good? Okay. I'll have to apologize now. I don't have time to edit my slides that say International Meeting for Autism Research. But I'll work on that. Right now I could use the quiet room, I feel. That would be really good. Those of you who know me probably know that the hardest part of this talk is going to be standing behind a podium for 45 minutes. I'm self-professed, self-diagnosed, as well as my kindergarten teacher diagnosing me with ADHD at a very young age, and so it's hard for me to stand still. I thought this would be a cozier group, so I thought we would have a conversation about heterogeneity and the biological constructs that contribute to autism heterogeneity. And I hadn't thought, it's an interesting topic. I think a lot of us have been thinking about this for a long time. I'm a novice. I still consider myself a novice given the other keynote speakers who've been working in autism for most of their scientific career. And about 6 weeks ago, I woke up at 3 a.m., and I can't tell you the exact language I used when I woke up and realized I have to give a talk on the biological origins of autism heterogeneity. So that's what I'm going to do. I did tell Jeremy Veenstra-Vanderweel I'd do him a favor. And this is not competing with NSAR, but there's a wonderful opportunity to take a course on autism that I taught in for 4 years with Susan Buchheimer and Dan Geschwin. And for graduate students, postdocs, and junior faculty, it's a fantastic way in 8 days to really come up to speed. And so there's all the information. Okay, and I put this up front so that I don't forget, and I'll name the, hopefully, not forget to name the people who are instrumental in some of the work that I'm going to be describing. And there's the laboratory. And for junior people, the most important thing about this slide is to recognize is that the more great collaborators you have, the better they make you look. So keep that in mind. Okay, so I just wanted to do a quick congratulations to Children's Television Workshop. Julia, you all know Julia? Yeah. So Barb Thompson, a colleague of mine at USC, sent me this link about Julia, and looking at Julia sort of jarred my memory. Back in 2008, my good friend and colleague Wendy Stone, we were at Vanderbilt together, and that's when Children's Television Workshop first approached her and Yvonne Lee about working on a character with autism spectrum disorder for Sesame Street. And then I realized as I looked at Julia and looked at her hair, and then looked at Wendy, I realized that she's had, I know there are other scientists and families that participated in this project, but I just wanted to start with this, that it's a fantastic development for the field, certainly for Wendy. She's going to kill me. Okay, so this is a quote from Kantor that puts this in perspective, and I'm a developmental neurobiologist, and so that's what I'm going to talk about today in the context of trying to frame why development is so complicated when it relates to when we're talking about the brain and how we can start to think about in some detail some of the factors that are contributing to changes in development that ultimately generate the heterogeneity that we see clinically. And so this is not a new concept, right? So most of the time people don't attribute this to Kantor, but if you read some of his very short essay of and if you read this, is as to be expected, individual differences in the degree of their disturbance, the manifestation of specific features, and the family constellation. So he got it, right? That individual differences is to be expected, specific features for each of the 11 children that he saw in his that he used to generate this paper. And I think we tend to forget that heterogeneity is a typical part of the development and functioning of species. Heterogeneity, individual differences, is important for survival of species. It's an important evolutionary concept. So, you know, what are the biological origins of this heterogeneity? I went into biology, just make it clear, because I thought all I'd have to do is look and describe. I didn't want to count anything. I didn't want to measure anything. I hated math. But I decided that I would overcome my early inhibitions and put up an equation. So that says D equals delta over T, right? And so D is the development, delta is change, and T is time. This is the essence of development, is change over time. And the problem is it's a system that's on the move. It's a system that's dynamic. It's a system, in some sense, that's unstable, meaning that trying to understand those factors that are contributing to creating a stable system from an unstable system as it's going through these changes is really quite a challenge. Now, there are factors, what I call kappas, and I just numbered 1, 2, 3, dot, 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 that are contributing to those changes, and we're going to talk about some of those in the next 45 or 50 minutes or so. And then there's time. So what are some of those biological factors? So here's a short list, I promise, if I can get this. Here we go. So there's heritable genomic variation that contributes to differences that we see read out in a developmental program. There's spontaneous mutations and variation, non-heritable changes in the genome that are contributing ultimately to how cells are going to be put together, how the nervous system is going to get wired together. There are different responses to experiences that are driven by a difference in the biology that occurs during this developmental period of time. There's epigenetics. There's differences in circuit vulnerability ultimately that are a reflection of both the heritable and spontaneous changes in the genome as well as experiences. Keep in mind, and I do a lot of policy talks to policymakers. They're challenging. I didn't insult any legislators here, did I? Okay. Yeah, you're right. The beauty of the brain is that it requires input, requires experience to drive its own development, right? And so those experiences are powerful in changing the biology as the brain is assembled. That's really critical, which is why the use of experience, or what we call interventions, right, is so powerful, because this is the natural course of how the nervous system changes developmentally and changes when it needs to change in terms of altering the course of development. And then a really important component to think about, and I'll talk about this a little bit, is biological activities depend upon cellular context. So in other words, to translate that into a language that a policymaker would understand, you can have the same molecule in two different cells, and the readout of whatever that molecule is doing can be quite different, right? And I'll talk a little bit about that's the concept of genetic pleiotropy. And so, and differences in regulation of molecular. Now, the good news is I'm not going to talk about each of those, so don't worry. So I'm going to give some context. For complex behaviors, heterogeneity is the norm. Disorder heterogeneity reflects this fact. If there's a normal distribution in the population in terms of heterogeneity of sociability, why do we expect that it wouldn't be the same for somebody who has a categorical diagnosis but is nonetheless part of this distribution in population, right? Research probing the biological basis of heterogeneity. I have to give some examples because I am a biologist, and so bear with me as I go through those. I promise it'll be detailed, but I'll skip over the details. So I'll talk about the heritability of heterogeneity of sociability. That's a kappa factor, right? That's one of those factors that's responsible for change during the developmental process. Pleiotropy, the idea that the same gene can actually have different effects depending upon the context, not only of the cells, but also of the state of the organism, and I'll show examples of that. I think we have to recognize and embrace the idea that we have to get more detailed in terms of understanding circuitry and circuit vulnerability, because in fact circuits mediate behavior. That's the output of the brain, and it's simply not good enough to talk about brain areas or even brain or even cortical layers. That there's such incredible specificity that in order for us to really understand what the structure-function relationships are that we're looking at in autism spectrum disorder and in other developmental processes, we have to get more detailed. And then I'll talk a little bit about developmental timing, which I think is an understudied area, which hopefully I'll convince you is important and relevant for all the work that you're doing in terms of thinking about when interventions are best applied and the circuits that you're hoping to target in terms of those interventions. And then you can tell I'm in grant writing mode because I have interpretations and pitfalls as my conclusions. I thought that was funny. Come on. Okay. We'll talk about balance. So, if you look at this diagram, I'm not a great artist, but if factor one and time two are the most important things in driving some developmental readout, the curve of development for whatever this phenotype is that you're measuring can look like this. But you can have balance go the other way, where a second factor is much more powerful in terms of a developmental process, and this is occurring during time three, and therefore the trajectory is changed in terms of development. So it's this balance, I think, that's really important and where we have a conundrum because we don't really understand what's controlling the balance between factors, right? So this is a little movie I got from Garrett Lavis, who's up at OHSU, who was emphasizing to me to start to think about and recognize the fact that broad differences in sociability across species or even within species is the norm. So Garrett left his house and then came back in 30 seconds later because he had forgotten something, and there's the response of his cat, right? And now Garrett also has a dog. He saw him 30 seconds ago, right? Okay, so that may or may not have anything to do with what I'm doing here. So it turns out that you can actually, this is a distribution of obviously across species, but there are some cats who are like dogs. I know I'm allergic to cats, so I'm not particularly fond of cats, but there's always a cat owner that tells me that their cat is always like a dog. My cat's just like a dog, so I say, well, why don't you just get a dog? And then there are some dogs for sure that are just like cats. But this is to emphasize that we have this distribution. And again, this distribution is important from an evolutionary perspective in terms of creating diversity, which is a great thing for species survival. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the heritable nature of social heterogeneity very briefly in terms of experiments that are ongoing now in the laboratory. You can deconstruct sociability into component parts in model systems, such as the work that we do and a lot of you do in mice. That there's, if you can measure a phenotype and there's continuous variation, it means that you can figure out from the perspective of heritability what part of that is responsible for variation in the phenotype, as long as you have a continuous measure and there's a big difference within the population. These can be mapped genetically to identify population variants. Circuits can be mapped that underlie these differences between low sociability and high sociability. And then genes can be identified and investigated as mediators of heterogeneity. So in work that Allison Knoll is doing in the laboratory, and she's been working on this for, seems like forever, but it's only been about 3 years. This is hard work. We use two common tasks they're used in mice. This three-chamber social choice, which where mice can go to one side or the other to interact with a mouse or an object or a novel mouse compared to a mouse that they've already seen, or direct social interaction, which is how mice operate in the cornfields, et cetera. They actually directly social interact. So you can take this construct and you can use what we call genetic reference panels of mice. This is not that complicated in thinking about, because you have two founders of mom and dad from two different strains, and so their genetic makeup is different, and you know you have the sequence for their genomes, and when you mate them, they produce offspring, and then you take those offspring, brothers and sisters, and you mate them, and you create essentially a family. The family has different contributions from B and D, right? And if you look at those chromosome stripes, you can see that, in fact, there is variation in this sort of genetic mosaicism that's based on the fact that you have these two parents of origin and you create this. And so you have a family, and with that family, you can then measure their phenotypes, the heritable part of these variations. And so Allison's been doing this with partner sniffing and direct social interaction, and you can see that there's about a four and a half to five-fold difference between the lowest and the highest. This is about 50 different lines, and ultrasonic vocalizations, 1,000-fold difference. And by the way, if you look, I don't know if you can see this, you see that black bar? That's C57 black 6 that most of us use to knock out genes and then look to see whether we can disrupt or lower USVs, ultrasonic vocalizations, or disrupt behavior. This is not the strain of choice if we had this information, because they're not very interactive, to be honest. Okay, so this is a complicated slide, but when you look at these measures and do factor analysis, you can see that what clusters together. Well, about 20% of the variance for factor one is based on activity, different components of the mouse behaving in that three-chamber or in direct social interaction. There's another factor that clusters around approach preference. There's another that focuses on social motivation. Look at those gray shaded lines. Novelty preference, fear learning, and anxiety. So we didn't cluster these beforehand. This is the principal component analysis basically telling us that these are component parts of social behavior that are related to each other, and they're reasonably heritable, which means that we can go in and map genes. And this is what Allison has been doing in the laboratory for ultrasonic vocalizations. In fact, we have a really wonderful peak on chromosome 18. There are 27 genes underneath, so that'll take another 15 years to figure out which genes we want to investigate. And then working with Pavel Osten in the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, we can actually take these different lines and try to understand what are the differences in circuit activation that account for this variability. I want to emphasize that this is not about finding new risk genes. This is about identifying genes that are responsible for heterogeneity in sociability, which may be important factors in titrating the effect of risk genes. And a number of you, I've heard talks from a number of you in the audience who've talked about the idea that these are important heritable components that can in fact define how a risk gene is going to be read out in terms of whether there's going to be a diagnosis or not, or whether there's going to be a perturbation or not. So it's important to know, however, that, you know, these genes that we're going to identify, they're going to be pleiotropic. All genes are, as far as I can tell. So we did a thought experiment. This is work that was led by Jasmine Plummer when she was in the laboratory, in which we basically took six disorders, and we identified, we went to the consortium, the genetic consortium, and they identified high confidence genes. And if you look at these six disorders in late 2015, early 2016, there were about 200. And if you look at how many of them are identified as high confidence genes in more than one psychiatric disorder, more than one DSM-5 diagnosis disorder, it's over 50%. Maybe not a surprise, but no one had actually sort of done that thought experiment. The thing that I was really interested in, because of our work in children with gastrointestinal disorders who have an autism diagnosis, is that if you go to OMIM and look at other diseases, non-psychiatric diseases, and then ask how many of those same genes that were identified in the psychiatric consortia are also identified as being risk, as being disease genes for respiratory or endocrine or GI, et cetera, it's over 50%. So I think that makes the point that this is complicated, because genes encode proteins that in different contexts perform different functions. Okay, so how do we investigate these factors, and how do we investigate time? And it's through developmental neurobiological experiments. So I have to talk for a period of time about the work that we've done in the lab, and rather than belabor and go into gory detail about any particular study, I try to put things together in a way to think about how this D equals delta over T can be informed by the kinds of biological experiments that we're doing and many, many other laboratories are doing. So we started working on this receptor tyrosine kinase back in 2003, just simply because it's an interesting developmental molecule. It's called the c-MET receptor. Talk about pleiotropy. It was discovered in 1986 as a proto-oncogene. So it's a cancer. So in fact, it's upregulated in tumor cells that are highly metastatic, because this receptor mediates cell movement of transformed cells. It also mediates movement of cells in the normal developing lung and in the kidney, but it doesn't do that in the nervous system, and I'll show you what it does in the nervous system. So I have to thank Berg and Geschwin for putting MET on top of the Legoland version of risk genes. I'm not sure this is a risk gene for autism spectrum disorder, but I think I'm pretty sure that it has important biological functions in development. So there it is there. So Barb Thompson, who's sitting over there somewhere, did this crazy set of experiments in which she conditionally disrupted this receptor in the cortex. That's called the dorsal pallium. That includes the cortex and hippocampus. And then she took this gene out of all neurons. You can't delete it out of the whole animal, because it's embryonic lethal, because this receptor is expressed in the placenta, et cetera. And so what she found is that if you delete it out of the cortex and hippocampus, the animals are hypoactive and they show this spontaneous alternation deficit. If you take it out of all neurons, they have a deficit in fear learning, elevated plus maze, they show some changes there as well. So non-overlapping phenotypes. I can't tell you how many reviewers said, well, that doesn't make any sense. If you knock it out of all neurons, that should cover everything, and then you get a subset of those. And unfortunately, it's not linearly related to each other. That this idea of balance, right, we've known this for years and years in the nervous system. If you occlude both eyes, right, the space in your visual cortex occupied by those eyes in terms of projections don't change. It's only when you occlude one eye and create this imbalance between left and right eye. And I can cite example after example from a developmental perspective where balance matters. So maybe that's the explanation. But clearly, deleting it out of different circuits will have different behavioral readouts. And then We discovered in 2013 that this receptor is expressed in a very small cell population of neurons in the Raphe that express serotonin. And Susan Demeke followed that up with a paper that basically showed that if you delete this receptor just out of those neurons, about 500 serotonin neurons, you get reduced social approach in a three-chamber assay. And we didn't see any social phenotypes when we deleted out of all neurons or out of the cortex itself. So what contributes to this diversity of behavioral outcomes? And from my perspective, it's trying to figure out which circuits are actually responsible from a developmental perspective that express this receptor, and how are the relationships between this receptor and the other proteins that it has to interact with, do they vary depending upon which circuits they're expressed in? And so we published this paper. Matt Judson was a graduate student in 2011. This is material that we got from David Amaral. That's a non-human primate, that big section down there. And you can see that big dark area is where there's tremendous amount of expression of this receptor. The mouse is boxed in up there, and you can see it's expressed throughout the cerebral cortex. In the primate, it's expressed in these areas. What are those areas? Superior temporal sulcus, really highly expressed in temporal lobe areas and posterior parietal and visual areas, areas that are involved in processing of sensory information that has social context to it. So this receptor is encoded by a gene. It has a remarkably specific pattern of expression in the primate. And the MET receptor, Dan Campbell did seminal work and we published this paper in 2006 in which Dan identified a promoter variant, which is circled with it, that's the C, that actually is biologically functional. So this variant has a very small effect on risk for an autism diagnosis. But from a biological perspective, that variant, which is sitting very close to the transcription start site, that little arrow that's going up and then across, reduces expression of this receptor by 50%. So that's a really big change in the levels of expression of this protein, right? And there are a number of studies that we've done, and it was summarized in this review that we published in Biological Psychiatry, that whether you're looking at a brain from a control group or from autism spectrum disorder, that CC genotype in that promoter region reduces your expression in the brain by 50%. That was a paper that Dan published in 2007. Jay Geed showed that in typically developing school-aged children, that if you look at gray matter growth in the temporal lobe, and he looked all over the brain, the effect size he saw was in the temporal lobe, that if you're CC, your gray matter growth trajectory is different than if you were what we would call the non-affected in terms of gene expression, the GG. I'll talk about some of the connectivity at the end that Susan Buchheimer, Mirella DiPrato, and Jeff Rudy did in a collaboration. You can see some of the other things that we saw. We identified this risk allele as being enriched in autism, in children with autism and gastrointestinal disorders. Dan Campbell and Judy Vanderwater have done work in the immune system as well as in the maternal autoantibody work. And Dan and Heather Volk have done work on relationship between this risk allele, this biologically functional allele, and air pollution. So which cortical circuits are vulnerable, right? Well, we can't really do this in primate. And so we turned back to the mouse to try to understand this, and it's turned out to be really important in terms of how we're thinking about this idea of kappas, the factors that may affect those changes over time. So we created a mouse that has a protein that we can see much easier than the receptor itself. It expresses this green fluorescent protein. If anything, it's pretty. Okay. And then over time, in the first 2 weeks in the mouse, you see this beautiful layering of the cortex, and you can see expression of this reporter, which is basically a reporter for the expression of the MET receptor in superficial layers nothing in layer 4, and of course some scatter cells in layer 5 and layer 6. So I'll get to it. So just to sort of keep this in mind, projection neurons can be divided into three principal classes: intratel and cephalic, those that are projecting from one cortical area to another, or from the cortex into the striatum; pyramidal tract excitatory neurons that are projecting subcortically and out of the telencephalon; and then the cortical thalamics. And you can see they're organized by layer, from layer 6, 5, 4, all the way up through layer 2. So Ryan Cass is a graduate student in the lab. So, well, let's figure out, boy, it looks like every cell in layer 2, 3 expresses this reporter. It looks like it's more scattered. But who's expressing this receptor? Which classes of cells? So I show this because it's pretty. He injected a tracer, and he can label the cells, and he can look to see what the overlap is between the cells that are labeled when you inject the thalamus and it gets transported back to the cortex. And you can say, well, how many of those cells have green fluorescent protein in them? That would mean that that categorizes that MET-positive cell as cortical thalamic, right? And so he did that. We also injected different cortical areas, and let's say, well, how many of those are projecting or receive projections from other cortical areas, that is the corticocortical, those projecting across the corpus callosum or on the same side. And so it turns out that in layer 6, just as an example, about 20-30% of the neurons that project from one cortical area to another express this receptor, and almost no cortical thalamic neurons express this receptor. So it's incredible specificity. So here's a summary of what he's done of what Ryan has done so far. There's literally no expression in layer 4. That's one of the principal zones that receives sensory input from the thalamus. About 40% of the corticocortical neurons in layer 2, 3, about the 30% in deeper layers. Keep in mind that superficial layers, layer 2, 3, and layer 5, and layer 6, they all have corticocortical neurons. They all have neurons that project from one cortical area to another. They receive different input. It's pretty clear that they process different kinds of information. And this is sort of speaking to my point that getting the details is really important, particularly in understanding how these circuits develop, because it's just not good enough for us to say, well, it's affecting a deep layer. I'm not saying that just because Matt is sitting in the front row. It's really important to understand which cell populations and which circuits they belong to. Okay. So this receptor is enriched in what we call IT, or intratel and cephalic cortical projection class, corticocortical neurons that are present both superficially and deep. Okay. So what's controlling this? How is it that you can have subpopulation? They're sitting next to corticocortical neurons that are not expressing this receptor. And so typically you look and say, okay, what are the transcriptional regulators? What are the transcription factors that control this? And it can make you dizzy in terms of thinking about the different combinations of these transcription factors that control gene expression. And it turns out that there's no overlap with the gene FOXP2, which we know is involved in language development. And this confirms the work that we did with Dan Geschwin's laboratory, in which FOXP2 looks to be a repressor of MET. So if it turns MET off or doesn't allow it to be expressed, you'd see them in different populations. And even for the untrained anatomist like Matt Stay, he can see that the green cells and the pink cells don't overlap with each other. Right, Matt? Okay. Here we go. All right. So it turns out that there is a transcription factor that overlaps tremendously with the expression of this receptor. It's called SATB2. SATB2 is a transcription factor that had been shown by Susan McConnell and others to control the development of these corticocortical neurons. And so here it is. Here's the quantitative analysis. I was told never to show a histogram in a small, intimate crowd like this, but I decided to do it anyway. And that number is about 80%. And transcription factors that control cortical spinal or cortical thalamic projections, they're not expressed in these MET-positive cells at all. So this all kind of makes sense, SATB2. And In a paper that was published by McKenna, we actually went back and looked at their data, open access data. They didn't mention this in their text, but there's about a 50% reduction in expression of the MET receptor in the SATB2 knockout. Not 100%, but 50%. So you scratch your head and you say, well, 80% of the neurons, there are 80% of MET positive neurons are expressing SATB2. So why isn't there an 80% reduction or even more? It's only 50%. So Ryan did this experiment, and I'm still blown away. This is in collaboration with Bin Chen, who was a postdoc with Sue McConnell and really did the great work to show how important SATB2 is in these cortical projection neurons as they develop. So this is localizing the gene in wild type, the normal mouse, and you can see this is in situ hybridization for the MET receptor. And I showed you in green, now you see it in purple. You see the labeling in the deep layers, and you see the labeling, they're the deep layers. And look at the knockout. The expression of MET in the deep layer cells is gone. But what else do you see? I'm waiting for an answer. Okay, forget it. All right. This is what you see. You see that the expression in the superficial neurons is intact. So you've got populations of cells that are co-expressing the receptor and the transcription factor that's regulating its expression. But for reasons that we still don't understand, it's regulating it only in the deep layered neurons, not in the superficial neurons. I told you it was going to be complicated, Craig. I told you that. Okay. So this is remarkable because only a subpopulation, which means that you can't really predict the biological outcomes by simply saying these are expressed together, therefore they must have some relationship with each other. That's really important. You have to do the experiment. So now we have an example where we can disrupt deep layer cells without disrupting superficial cells in terms of expression of this receptor. And I'll show you in a moment why that's important. So we've demonstrated now differential vulnerability of subpopulations of neurons. So why is that important? In some sense, think about it this way. It's creating a mosaic of sort. If you disrupt the expression of this receptor, you've got a mosaic of neurons that are not going to express this receptor, the MET receptor, and some that are. And let's see why that matters. So what in the world is this receptor doing? I haven't told you that, and I'm not going to. No. Okay. So we approach this in several ways. One is to figure out, well, proteins don't interact, don't do functions by themselves. They're very social. In fact, they require social engagement. That is, they require interacting with other proteins in order to do their job. So this receptor is enriched. That is, it's found highly at developing synapses, which is a really good thing for us because we thought, given its pattern in terms of when it was expressed, in terms of time, both in the primate and human brain, as well as in the rodent, that it corresponded to these times of rapid synapse formation. In the human, it's not expressed in mid-gestation. By the time the third gestational period comes, it starts to go up, and then postnatally, it's incredibly high. And that's exactly the period of time when rapid synapse formation is occurring in the cortex. 1 to 2 million synapses per second are being formed during that period of time. So I hate these. Don't you? You guys hate these? Okay, I'll cover it up. So that was the MET interactome. We actually used an antibody and pulled the receptor out of the membrane, and we said, well, what proteins are interacting with it? And it turns out there's 72 proteins, and then you can build a network of who those proteins are interacting with. And what we found is that the proteins that directly interact with this receptor in a developing synapse, well, those are proteins encoded by genes that have been implicated in autism spectrum disorder and other neurodevelopmental disorders. But if you look at those genes encoding proteins implicated in bipolar or schizophrenia, there's no enrichment there at all. So this receptor is interacting with proteins that have already been implicated by others, both genetically in terms of the biology in ASD and in other neurodevelopmental disorders. And it turns out that when you say, okay, here are these 72 proteins, do they co-express? Are they regulated in some way? And it turns out both in terms of developmental time and in terms of the cortical areas, there are highly correlated expression patterns. So that means that we've got a network that actually has some functional relevance, right? And so there's another component to this, which I think is really important. I just sort of blow this up to give you a... We look at these ball and stick figures, these networks, and think, okay, so here are the interactions. But it turns out that these interactomes are dynamic. So we did a simple experiment. We just basically said, okay, well, let's activate this receptor. Let's activate the MET receptor with this ligand and say, well, can we measure how these particular interactions change? So here are three examples. NTRK3 is TRAC-C. That's a receptor for a growth factor. Whether or not you activate the MET receptor, there's no change in the amount of TRAC-C and MET that interact with each other. SYNGAP1, which is clearly a causal for autism spectrum disorder, and is really quite interesting because it's involved in synapse maturation as well. Well, there's about a 40% decrease in the interaction of the MET receptor with SYNGAP1 at developing synapses when you activate the receptor. mGluR5, that's GRIM5, that actually goes up. Right, so depending upon, and I'm not showing you others, beta-catenin, and a very important protein involved in synapse development, interacts with the MET receptor, and when you activate the MET receptor, that also changes. So these interactomes are dynamic, and they change depending upon the physiological state of the cells during development, and I'll show you why that's important. The other thing is that activation of this receptor in the same neuron controls multiple outcomes. So here's this complicated diagram that Dan Campbell drew way back in 2009, or maybe it was the journal that drew it and he liked it. And so if you activate this receptor, it works through different pathways that essentially transduce the signal. Remember, the receptor is on the plasma membrane. You have to transduce that signal and get some kind of a cellular response. So what happens if you activate this receptor? Well, it turns out that you can enhance dendritic growth, but that only occurs through this ERK-MAP kinase pathway. You can see on one side. And if you activate the receptor, same cell, and inhibit MAP kinase pathway with a drug, and activate through this PI3 kinase pathway, you get increases in synapse formation without having any effect on the dendrite. So now we've got another kappa. We have another factor. That is, if there's some difference in the balance between what's controlling the intracellular signaling, you can essentially alter dendritic growth or alter synapse formation and essentially desynchronize them, right? Spatially and temporally desynchronize them because you've got the same receptor signaling and transducing what it's supposed to be doing physiologically in multiple ways. Have I made it any easier yet? Is it less complicated? No, okay. All right, so how many kappas are there for just one gene? Well, we've shown unique expression patterns. Distinct regulation of this gene in different neurons, to me, that's mind-blowing because I don't really understand how you have a transcription factor that regulates the expression of a gene in some cells but not others, right? That's still, and it's real, but we have to figure that one out. There's a dynamic interaction with partner proteins that relate to controlling dendritic growth and synapse formation, but keep in mind where this receptor is expressed, in subpopulations of cortical neurons for the most part. And co-regulation with functional partners varies by circuit. And the balance of signaling is going to impact development as well. So this is one gene, five kappas, right? You can see how complicated it's going to get. So one of the things that was discovered by a postdoc in the lab, Shenfeng Xu, turned out to be really important in terms of my thinking about how to put together these developmental phenomena, putting together change over time, because after all, that's what development is about. Well, Shenfeng discovered that when you delete this gene out of the cortex or the hippocampus, you actually increase the rate of maturation of the synapse about a week and a half earlier than it should, right? And there are a number of different ways in which you can determine that electrophysiologically. I'm not going to go into it. But the other thing that he showed, this is just, you don't have to look at the details. This reminds me to say this, is that When you knock this receptor out, and we know it's involved in synapse formation, we looked at 20, 30, 40 different proteins that are enriched at the synapse, and we didn't see any wholesale change of expression of those proteins. What we saw instead were changes in where those proteins were distributed. So, for example, this receptor is in part responsible for how much glutamate receptor is placed into the plasma membrane without changing the levels of expression of the receptor at all. And that's another trick that neurons use. That is, you don't have to change the levels of expression of the gene or the protein. You basically can use mechanisms of where you put that protein in order for it to function or in order to hide its function. Okay. And so essentially what we do when we delete this gene is we shift the period of time in terms of maturation, and that will have an effect on sensitive and critical periods, right? So that's what that diagram is all about. So the same experience you would predict leads to different functional outcomes. If you have an experience at one time, and in one individual, the nervous system is in one state of maturation, the synapse, and another, it's in a more mature state of maturation, that same experience will have different outcomes. So timing matters, right? In development and also in response to interventions. Think about the shift in maturation and why early interventions may actually be incredibly important, not just to capture a developmental trajectory that's happening on a typical pace, but rather to understand that that pace may actually vary depending upon how the biology of the nervous system and the circuits are being altered, right? So MET's involved in synapse building. It goes away, and it's involved in two processes. Number one, synapse building, and number two, when it goes away, the synapse is mature. If you overexpress this receptor, you actually keep the synapses in an immature state. So depending upon how much balance you have with this protein, okay, we have another half hour. No, I'm just kidding. depending upon this balance, you can change the rate at which these synapses are forming, are maturing. So in some sense, MET is creating a timing mosaic, right, of the schedule of synapse formation. So what if there were 10 different METs, or maybe 100 different METs, maybe 1,000 different proteins that are involved not just in the process of making a synapse, but in fact regulating the time over which those synapses mature? That's going to have a really important outcomes in terms of how that circuit is going, the developing circuit is going to respond to experience. So there's my thought experiment. So here's the real experiment that was done by Hunke Yoon Johnson to demonstrate that this matters, right? So she was doing experiments using an early life stress paradigm that Tali Barham had developed, limited bedding, and she replicated findings that are in the literature. If you expose pups to early life stress in the first week of life and then you look later on in adults, you get a reduction in dendritic complexity. Others have shown that if you actually don't do the early life stress until week two, you get an increase in dendritic complexity, right? These are just wild-type mice. So the timing of when the early life stress occurs, in this essence, is defining how those neurons are responding to that experience. So what happens if you do something clever like a gene-by-environment experiment? And so Hunke did that, and so we used MET heterozygous mice that have a reduction in expression of this receptor. By itself, it reduces dendritic complexity. Now, keep in mind, these neurons and their synapses are like, when you delete this receptor, are like a week two neuron. So what happens? You get an increase in dendritic complexity, demonstrating that that timing change, the timing of maturation, actually has a completely different physiological and developmental outcome. So let me throw in some interpretations and balance, and then I'll finish. MET's not alone in this. So this is a paper that has just come out from Tom Sudow's laboratory. Neurexins are synaptic adhesion molecules that are present at all synapses, right? And there are two striking. So in this work, they deleted these all the genes. So there are four flavors, I think, right? And they deleted them all. So they called it a pan-neurexin mutant mouse. They make synapses, believe it or not. Right? So what did they find? They find that when you knock all these genes out, that there's diverse synaptic phenotypes in the synapse-specific matter. They looked in the cerebellum and they looked in the cortex. Deleting this molecule that we know is important in building a synapse actually has different physiological outcomes because the context of a developing neuron in the cerebellum that expresses this protein is different than the context of the same protein being expressed in a cortical neuron building a synapse there, right? Really important. So the phenotypes confirm sort of an organizer function but with different physiological readouts. Okay, that makes it even more complicated. And so I think of these kappas, these risk and phenotypic modulators, as being able to kind of shift this, the global phenotype, let's say, of measure of sociability in one direction or another. And so here's an example where context matters. So this is a paper that Jeff Rudy did, the work that he did with Mirella DiPreto and our very own Susan Buchheimer. And it was a neuroimaging study in which we genotyped the teenagers who were in the study for the risk allele. Remember, it's CC. And this is just one functional measure of connectivity between the posterior cingulate cortex and medial prefrontal cortex. And there's some things about this that are striking. So we have them separated off into genotype by color. You can see gray, brown, and green. Typically developing teenagers and those with autism spectrum disorder. And what you notice is that the connectivity, irrespective of diagnosis, if you're GG, that connectivity between these two brain areas in this neuroimaging study are identical. There's no difference. That makes sense because we know when we look at the distribution in any neuroimaging study or other studies in humans, there's overlap, right? That they don't, the groups don't segregate out completely. If you look at whether there's a difference between the heterozygote, CG, in the typically developing individuals, there's no difference between those individuals and GG. There is a difference if you're CC in typically developing. But look at the effect difference in teenagers with autism spectrum disorder. You can already see that if you have one of those C alleles and you have the diagnosis, that your connectivity between these two brain areas is decreased. And then it has a massive change when you look at the homozygous CC in autism spectrum disorder compared to typically developing. So here's a variant where it matters, the context, not just in terms of the cellular and developmental context that I've been talking about, but also in terms of the context of the individual, because the brain is not separated from the rest of the body. This is really important, I think. And so this is this balance idea that really is describing these factors. And so, you know, we have findings in terms of brain growth trajectory. This is a paper that came out in Nature recently with from the network showing between 6 and 12 months increased brain growth rates. And then this wonderful paper that I really like, I'm not just saying this because Tony Charman is here at the meeting, but this is a really nice hypothesis about overpruning as well. And so you could imagine that depending upon the balance between these K's and T's, you could impact the trajectory of growth early as well as impact what's going to happen later on when you have to prune away some of those connections, just as in typically developing developmental processes, right? We build and then we prune. Okay, so I want to thank IMSAR, sorry about the FAR, and plug Science Day that my granddaughter Molly went to. I was out of town, and I think she makes an important point as she's 6 years old, and it is the case that even princesses love science too. So I want to thank everybody for paying attention.